The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. So tonight I'd like to continue the series that I started on refuge. So 2 weeks ago I spoke about refuge in the Buddha. And last week I talked about refuge in the Dharma. And you probably won't be surprised when I say that tonight I'm going to talk about refuge in the Sangha. And so the first week I talked a little bit about refuge as an orientation. And then the second week, refuge as a transformation. And tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about refuge as an emotion. Maybe to take refuge, to go for refuge. In some kind of way, we might consider it as a type of homecoming, a place where we feel safe, where we feel secure. Maybe we feel a sense of integrity, or we feel sincere. Or maybe there's something that's not even quite clear what it is, but just a feeling like, oh yeah, okay, this feels like home. I often hear people describe their experience when they're discovering the Dharma as being like that. A sense of homecoming, where they feel more open or connected, or maybe with a certain resonance. So that might be one way in which we can understand refuge as this movement of the heart, or maybe something that's not quite so clearly articulated in the mind, but a feeling of rightness, maybe, something like that. Sometimes this expression of I'm going for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is described as refuge in the three gems, or the triple gems, or the three jewels sometimes. We have that expression too. And the commentaries expand this by saying that the word for gem, ratana, could also be interpreted as that which induces, brings, produces, and increases the light. So going for refuge is associated with delight, is this feeling of, well, maybe uplifting, or maybe even a type of gladness, or some, of course, a certain amount of happiness, or kind of, you know, it's associated with some positive internal experience. I don't know, I love this idea of that it's something that maybe it increases delight to go for refuge is something that's a pleasant experience. It's not something that's born out of obligation or a sense of this is what I should do. But instead it's a feeling of coming home, a feeling of ease, a certain well-being, which may be a vague, diffuse experience, but to the sense of maybe being aligned with something that's important. So I've been talking about the Buddha and the Dharma, and I'll talk about the going for refuge in the Sangha. But there's also those things that we maybe unknowingly take refuge in which turn out not to be so helpful. And some of the internal things that we take refuge to, and we probably wouldn't use this language, but if we consider it, we might notice that our mind likes to go to different places for refuge. It's as if the mind believes that there might be some increased safety if we just plan and plan and plan, or if we just worry and worry, if we just worry enough, then everything will be safe. Or if we just figure everything out, then we'll be safe and we'll find a secure place. Or maybe if we're just critical enough and complain and critique ourselves and everybody else, the environment, the whatever experience we're having, and just criticize it and complain about it. These might be ways in which our mind is trying to find some safety. And maybe if we have the sense, if I just become more perfect, if I just improve myself in some ways, this never-ending self-improvement project, then I'll be able to be safe. Once I get to, you know, these forever moving goalposts, as soon as I get to this, well, okay, maybe really that. And these habits of mind, these movements towards trying to find safety in these types of ways, I'm sure we've adopted them because at one time, or maybe sporadically, maybe sometimes, they do provide some safety. Maybe they do provide a little bit of a sense of well-being. But maybe they're not always the sense of refuge that they have been, or maybe they're just simply no longer a sense of refuge, but it's a habit now and we can no longer, it's so familiar that we don't even recognize that we're doing it. So these are false refuges, some of these habits of behavior or habits of mind. And there might be some external false refuges as well, that is, refuges that are not our inner life, but the way that we show up in the world or what we are working towards or wanting to move towards. Things like work, our livelihoods, or our finances, or maybe relationships we've had, or things in society being a certain way, or our health. And when these change, which of course they do, it becomes really stressful when our well-being was dependent on them being in a particular way, having a particular title in our profession. And then when we retire, having a little bit of a crisis or some difficulties, or maybe, you know, any identity that we might be taking on, or ways about our health, capabilities that we might have, or bank accounts, all kinds of things that we believe are going to provide security and safety. And it's not that they don't, but they're not complete safety. They're not true refuges. They're not infallible. And there's a verse in the Dhammapada that talks about this. It goes like this. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. So here is this, taking it literally, like going for refuge. They're going somewhere, right, to the physical locations, trees, parks, forests. Probably they didn't have bank accounts back then, right? But this idea that it was something external, that as long as they were in some particular physical location, would they find some safety? That was reliable, consistent, a secure refuge, a supreme refuge. And then this passage continues by saying, what is a supreme, secure refuge? When someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the eightfold path that leads to the end of suffering. Then this is a secure refuge. This is a supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So this is an internal experience, seeing with wisdom, oh yeah, okay, here is difficulty. We're using this word suffering, right? And it's a generic word that expresses a wide spectrum to something that's just a little bit mildly annoying or irksome to really serious suffering. So that word suffering, dukkha, in Pali, where it often gets translated as suffering, but we could also say dissatisfaction or stress or something else. So this recognition that seeing with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering. So seeing honestly, what are the difficulties? And seeing what conditions do these difficulties arise? And how are they overcome, in which they go away? This is related to the Eightfold Path, these eight steps, that eight aspects of our experience that we can use to explore, to see the arising of suffering and what the overcoming of suffering, and understanding that with wisdom. So instead of going to some physical location, it's about having an understanding. It's about seeing with wisdom. So perhaps it isn't until we begin to understand some of the different sources of our suffering, and that we also, and how there's said, the obvious suffering and the obvious sources of it. Maybe we have illness, and maybe it's due to an injury, or something like this. Maybe we don't even know exactly what it is, but there's physical pain due to a disease we might have. It's not until we start to understand suffering and some of the sources of suffering that we might begin to really understand what provides safety and protection and sanctuary. Maybe it's not what, you know, served as protection when we were younger, but only when we start to have a better understanding with suffering do we really start to understand refuge. And then to have refuge in the Sangha, there's a number of different definitions for Sangha. I'm just going to talk about two. One, which we find in the discourses, that is the Sangha of those individuals who have achieved some degree of awakening, who have tasted freedom, who have some level of enlightenment or awakening. And then there's the conventional, maybe contemporary, definition of Sangha, that is fellow practitioners, that people that we practice with. And sometimes we talk about even like this Sangha that's on YouTube. Those of you who sometimes put in the chat box, hello from in your location. It's a beautiful thing. I find it very sweet and touching. And in some ways, it kind of feels like this is a Sangha too, the Monday night YouTube Sangha. So I'll start with a little bit about the Sangha of those individuals that have achieved some awakening. Interestingly, this has nothing to do whether a person is ordained or is a householder. It has nothing to do with what gender they have. It has nothing to do with their background, what they look like, the color of their skin, their racial background, their ethnic background, their sexual orientation. It has nothing to do with any of these things. Instead, it's related to what they do. So going for refuge in the Sangha is related to, it's not said explicitly, but the language is exactly the same. So in my view, it's implied, similar to this practice of both recollection of the Sangha, that is, bringing the Sangha to mind as a formal practice. And when you do that, like, who is the Sangha that you're bringing to mind? As well as having unwavering confidence in the Sangha. Avecha Pasada, and that's the expression in Pali for unwavering confidence. And the way that the Sangha is described in this way is the Sangha of the Blessed One's followers, that is, the Buddha's followers, who have practiced well, who have practiced straightforwardly, who have practiced methodically, who have practiced masterfully. I feel really touched by this, actually. There's something actually really inspiring when you see that someone has really, maybe we might say, excelled at their craft. Or I don't know, what comes to mind is live performances or athletic events. I've had this experience, and maybe you've had similar experiences. I'm bringing one to mind where I've seen a performance where this person was singing, and her voice, it just felt like, I don't know, like her, all of her being was coming through the microphone, and it was just something magnificent. I just felt myself, like the hairs stand up on my body, and I had like tears coming down. It was just such a beautiful expression. I've also seen this with dance, seeing like live performance of dance, when just to see people, maybe they're, I don't know what their interior experience is, of course, but there's something grace that's coming through, it feels like, or something true. And I don't know what the words are exactly, but it feels like these are people who have practiced well, straightforwardly, methodically, masterfully. So maybe in the same way, the Sangha of the individuals who have done this eightfold path that was described in earlier in that passage, these eight different aspects of a person's life that are expressed beautifully, and you can feel it and you can sense it in them. And in such a way that it's inspiring, like that expressing the potential of humans in some kind of way, in a way that feels beautiful. So to take refuge in that, to take refuge in the purity of this expression. And in this passage about describing the followers that have practiced well, but it does go on. The next passage is to say those individuals who have achieved one of the four levels of awakening. I'm not going to go into the details of this. And those who are on the way to achieve each of those four levels of awakening. So, I don't know, I feel touched by this. Like, it doesn't matter specifically what levels of awakening they are, but to be on the way also counts here, right? As one of the Sangha, as being a member of the Sangha. And then these passages continue that a consequence of recollecting the Sangha, those people who have practiced well, practiced masterfully, when the follower of the Noble One are recollecting the Sangha, bringing them to mind, which is very similar to taking refuge, if not the exact same thing. So when followers of the Buddha do this, Their minds are not overcome with passion. Their minds are not overcome with aversion. Their minds are not overcome with delusion. Their minds head straight based on the Sangha. Right? So we don't have these unwholesome roots are not being expressed when we are tuning into or recollecting, being inspired by people who have practiced masterfully. And when then this passage continues, and when the mind is headed straight, followers of the Buddhas, the noble ones, gain a sense of the goal, gain a sense of the Dharma, gain gladness connected with the Dharma. So there is this sense of delight. There's a sense of well-being. There's a sense of okayness, gladness. And then it continues. It doesn't stop there. In one who is glad, joy arises. In one who is joyous, the body grows calm. In one whose body is calmed has happiness. In one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. So this, sometimes it's called the gladness pentad. Gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. We find this a number of places in the discourses, and there's a number of different things that get the gladness going. In this case, it's recollection of the Sangha. It also is recollection of the Dharma, recollection of the Buddha, and recollection of a number of different things. So it's not just the Sangha, but it's this bringing to mind things that are supportive for practice, or part of the Buddhist practice, is in which gladness arises. And then it's a cascade that goes from gladness to joy to tranquility to happiness and concentration. And then from concentration, a number of things can happen, including awakening. So this way that taking refuge in the Sangha, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, is a way in which can be a real support for practice. That is, it's not just something that we do every now and then, perhaps when we're on retreat, or it's something nice to do on occasion, but it can be an integral part of our practice. Recollection of the Sangha, taking refuge in the Sangha. So now I want to talk a little bit about Sangha as our fellow practitioners. All of us on YouTube right now, maybe. And for this, maybe before I begin that, I'll say for me, this has been really important. Absolutely. I've talked about this a few times, about just how important it was for me to meet other people that were doing this practice. I didn't know anybody who was meditating. When I first found the Dharma, I was in corporate America and had a very different life that had, you know, different orientation. And this, just to meet people that were so nice, kind, people who had a sincerity about them, and I just enjoyed talking with them and talking about the Dharma. Sometimes with hearing teachings and then talking about them, or books talking about them, and things that we didn't understand talking about them. I don't know, I found, honestly, a refuge. And people who really took seriously some of the teachings on right speech, so there wasn't putting down people, there was a real sense of integrity, of sticking to what is true, not gossiping or anything like this. And it's had such a big impact on my practice and my retreat practice, my first 3-month retreat was somebody that I didn't know so well. I knew a little bit. And she went on that retreat also. And something, you know, having gone through that experience together, these 3 months of meditating, it really, I feel like we have a bond now. That even, you know, we didn't speak, of course, for those months, but just sitting together hour after hour, day after day, week after week, month after month, there's something, a bond that happens, and it's been such a huge support. It's a huge support to have other people that have that experience to do that with others. So I just share from me, and even like it's a scene here on YouTube in the chat box, it's a support for all of us. So I think all of us have, in some way or other, are, of course we're influenced by others, and the support that it provides, maybe directly, maybe indirectly. And there's a little discourse that tells this story about this, and it's about Meghya. Meghya was the attendant to the Buddha. This is before Ananda was the attendant. And Meghya wants to go and meditate. Earlier in the day, he saw a mango grove that was really attractive for meditating. And he wanted to go. So he said to the Buddha, I'd like to go meditate in the mango grove that I saw earlier. And the Buddha says, no, it's not the right time. The Buddha likes to have an attendant, and it was just the two of them, and if Meghya left, the Buddha would have been alone. And then Meghya asks a second time, and he says something along the lines of, I still have work to do, you don't have work to do, but I do, I want to go meditate. And the Buddha says, no, I think you should wait. Meghya asks a third time, and the Buddha says, okay, you know, if you asked a third time, which is often kind of the tradition if you ask 3 times. So Meghya goes and meditates, and while he's meditating, he exclaims, it's amazing that even though I have ordained, even though I have gone from the home life to homelessness, I am ensnared by these 3 bad, unwholesome thoughts. That is to say, by the thoughts of sensual pleasure, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. So he's just amazed, you know. And he has reportedly maybe the best meditation teacher that has ever existed. And he has opportunities to practice, but still he had these experiences of all these unwholesome thoughts arising and disturbing his meditation. So he goes back to the Buddha and reports what's happened. And the Buddha responds, Meghya, for those whose freedom of mind is not fully mature, there are few things that lead to this maturity. And what are they? The first is to have a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade. This is the first thing that leads to greater freedom of mind. I appreciate very much it's good friend, companion, and comrade. 3 synonyms. Maybe these have 3 different levels of intimacy. Maybe it's somebody that we don't even know, but just knowing about them, knowing that they're meditating, knowing that they're watching YouTube, or whatever it might be. Maybe we've only seen them on Zoom, haven't ever interacted with them. But the Buddha saying that this is the first thing that leads to maturity, of maturity of freedom of mind. So taking refuge in the Sangha, those who have practiced in such a way that we feel so inspired. And maybe some of those people are our friends, companions, and comrades. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're just fellow people walking the path. But taking refuge in knowing or having companions on this path, such a big part of our practice. So may you take refuge. May you find safety, protection in the Buddha, the Dharma, and a Sangha in a way that supports you and supports your life so that we can support others, so that our practice can be maybe an exemplar for others, or maybe just building those bridges that need to be built, or offering support where support is needed. Thank you.